I sort of thought I had turned in this title as my talk for today. It seems like the rest of the week my titles match up. The one that's on the schedule really sounds like me. Sounds like something I'd say. So I must have turned that in sometime, but I don't know. This is what I've got on my title slide. So we're going to talk a little bit about how climate change might affect some of the communities, some of the basic ideas behind it, and a few of the actual problems with the way that people have looked at some of the impacts of climate change. There's one particular theme that's going to keep coming up, and that's taking it too literally that air temperature is the primary driver, and that's really going to be the subject of my Wednesday talk. What is temperature and why doesn't it matter? So yeah, that's a hyperbole for purposes of attracting attention, but there are ways in which it doesn't matter as much as people tend to think. So with that, we'll go ahead. So the main themes: human-caused climate change is real. It's mostly caused by greenhouse gases, but some other factors are not negligible. Natural variability is real as well, and that is something that kind of masks the actual effects of it. So you can get spurious things that are not directly connected to climate change caused by greenhouse gases. Uncertainty is real, and types of uncertainty are not created equal. So that's the hierarchy of uncertainty that was on the talk, the title of the talk on the official schedule. Then a little summary of the next few talks. Developing countries are likely to be most vulnerable. So that's my talk for tomorrow. Air temperature is not the sole determinant of impacts. There are a lot more interactions going on in the system. And that'll be Wednesday's talk, and that's going to feature the infrared giraffe. So you'll have to look forward to that. And science can't be short-circuited by people just saying, I think such and such is going on. Science really requires more than that. So Thursday's talk is going to feature the parable of Oli, the supermarket manager. All right, so here's a one-question preliminary quiz for this talk. Which greenhouse gas absorbs more infrared radiative energy than any other in the Earth's atmosphere?
Methane.
No. CO2.
Methane?
It's one.
No. No one's gotten it yet.
What are the chlorofluorocarbons?
Water. It's water vapor. And I'll show this next.
Because there's so much of it, or because it in itself holds more than all those each of those other.
It's because there's so much of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and one of the key differences between water vapor and carbon dioxide, methane, some of those others that you were talking about, is that the way that those others get into the atmosphere and stay there is man-made. They stay there for a long time. The carbon dioxide is going to be there for centuries. The water vapor, on the other hand, is not directly influenced by humans primarily. It's evaporation from whatever surfaces you have, oceans, lakes, land, plants, all that. And it cycles in and out of the atmosphere very quickly, but it's sensitive to the air temperature. The air can hold so much as a function of its temperature. So the guy in the picture there is my old PhD advisor, and his name is Suki Manabe, 1967. he made the first computer simulation of climate change due to CO2. That's when he published it.
Was that the Hawaii study that went on over the course of?
No, but it was motivated by that.
Okay.
So yeah, I'll show some of those results a little later. So what he did is contrasted these are the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, and he really treated the whole world's atmosphere as just one column. So you've got just one result for the whole world. And did it two different ways. One is with fixed absolute humidity, so this was kind of what they were considering the present day amount at that time. So just ran the simulation and changed the amount of CO2 content without changing the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. So that, by doubling the CO2, you got a warm-up of just over 1 degree Celsius. But then, using fixed relative humidity, that meant that an increase in air temperature would allow more water vapor into the atmosphere. And that doubled the amount of warming that was projected. Okay, so frequently asked questions. If someone were to say it's 107 degrees in the shade today, does this prove that global warming is real? No. So, in any case, here's one of the potential effects of global warming. Might have Tom Cruise with some stains in his armpits, or Gwyneth Paltrow sweating from her face. Another frequently asked question, we had frost in August, does this mean that global warming is not happening? Again, no. So, a whole lot of the questions that I get from people are some variant of this one. Weather has been weird, some particular thing has happened. Is it global warming? And the answer is maybe and maybe not. And you know, if it's a fairly isolated event, it's really tough to attribute it to global warming. It has to be more of a pattern across time and space before you can really attribute it to climate change. And that's why we look at very long records in order to address it on an observational level. So, one of the things that I stress is that the interactions that lead to climate are very complex, and I reformatted this from sort of a different background, and it turned out a little strange. But the basic point of this is that these interactions are a spaghetti diagram, so I'm calling this the real world simplified. And I won't go over everything in here, but I'd like to point out that those two ovals up at the top represent how the whole Earth system is exchanging energy with outer space. You get some in from solar radiation on the left, that's the sun, and long-wave radiation. I'm going to concentrate on that a little bit more in the What is Temperature on Wednesday. And then the rectangles toward the middle there are characteristics of the atmosphere. The ovals toward the bottom are exchanges of heat energy and momentum and moisture between the atmosphere and the surface. So those kind of processes are really key to what comes out of this. And then way at the bottom are characteristics of the atmosphere. of the surface, sorry. And another thing I wanted to point out is...
What's albedo? Sorry.
Oh, albedo is the amount of sunlight that would be reflected from... that's you asking that up there. All right. Trying to figure out where that voice is coming from. All right.
So like white ice is very reflective.
Yep.
Darker.
Yeah, and the ocean is really the least reflective surface on the Earth. A dark forested area is relatively low reflectivity. Deserts are higher, and ice is about the highest. So some of the ways that differences in temperature, yeah.
Just the term friction, where how does that fit in?
That's that's the air being impeded in its motion by elements of the ground and of plants, trees. Yeah, and even the ocean will impose friction on the air. So, yeah, when I said that's a transfer of momentum, that's slowing down the motion of the atmosphere. So things that really drive differences in temperature, really the big one is the solar radiation in the upper left, and that gives you the seasons of the year. You have a change between winter and summer, between how much of that sunlight is coming in. And then on the sort of weather forecast time scale, a few days, you're going to get changes in temperature. And those are mainly due to which way the wind is blowing. Is it blowing in air from a warmer or colder area? And then we have the greenhouse gases. And what those are about is the downward long-wave radiation. So you're driving changes in temperature from different parts of this whole chart here, and they're going to have different effects on various parts of this whole system. So you have to watch out for assuming that air temperature is really the driver. It's really coming from other areas and propagating into
Brent,
the air temperature.
Can you tell us about long wave?
Yeah. On Wednesday, you'll see the infrared giraffe. And the basic thing about long wave radiation, and I think they did a poor job of telling me about this in school, they told me the ways that you can transfer energy are conduction, convection, and radiation. And everything surrounding you is emitting long-wave radiation. And for solid objects, it's pretty closely correlated to their temperature. For gases, they have to have a certain temperature and have greenhouse gas content to absorb and emit long wave radiation. So it's light that's at non-visible wavelengths. Military application is wear these infrared goggles and go out and look for the tailpipe of some military vehicle, or you can even see humans walking around in a nighttime landscape using those.
So it's the vehicle that sort of transmits heat?
Yeah. Okay. At the speed of light, right through the air. So yeah, it's generally not visible to us, but it's the same principle as things that get somewhat hotter will get red hot, so you can actually see it, and you can feel that heat just coming at you right through the air. rather than actually blowing at you, which would be convection.
I have a comment. So yeah. Would it be accurate then to say the surface of the sun that say 8 or 10,000 degrees is putting out shortwave radiation that mostly goes through the atmosphere? When it hits the surface of the Earth, it's re-radiated as long-wave radiation, which goes through the atmosphere in a much less efficient way. So it's a bit like a one-way mirror. Is that the way I've heard it described?
Yeah. Yeah. How to sum that up? I mean, essentially, that's it. That there's a large percentage of the shortwave radiation from the sun, which some of it is visible, some of it is not invisible wavelengths, but it's primarily absorbed at the surface. Then the surface has its own temperature with its characteristic wavelengths of emission of long-wave radiation. Yeah, and the greenhouse gases impede that from escaping from the atmosphere. Okay, so climate is really a game of odds. You have a certain chance of getting certain conditions, and it's like rolling dice, but you might end up weighting the dice differently. Any single roll of the dice cannot prove whether or not the dice are weighted to have a higher chance of rolling a particular number, and even many, many rolls of the dice can't prove that they're weighted a certain way with zero uncertainty. There's always some uncertainty left. And another point is weather and climate observations are not labeled to distinguish global warming from natural variability. It's just a temperature. It's just a precipitation measurement. There's nothing that says this part of it is due to natural causes and this part is due to human causes. Climate modeling and observation. Lay audiences tend to forget that there are certain things that we understand about, when I say lay audiences, I mean not scientific specialists in this area. There are certain things that we understand about the way that greenhouse gases act, and we can make those into models. So on the one hand, observation gives reliable information about the past, but you can also use models. And those are the main source of projections for the future. They're less reliable. There's a little bit of a leap of faith in using a model, but many of the basic principles behind it are well understood. So, in a broad brush sense, they're pretty reliable, but a lot of the details are a little more suspect. So putting those two together, model predictions and observations, gives you a more convincing case for global warming than either alone. So here's the Mauna Loa observations that you were asking about, Scott. And this is the longest time series of observations of atmospheric CO2, started in 1957 or 58. Forgotten the exact date. I remember they had the 50th anniversary celebration of that a few years ago. I didn't manage to make it there for that. But the red curves are the actual measurements, and they have an annual wiggle, and that's due to the greening up of the northern hemisphere on an annual basis. So late summer is the minimum of CO2 concentrations. And that's what creates the annual wiggle, but then they've removed that wiggle in order to get the black curve. So what we consider pre-industrial, which predates the start of this time series, is about 280 parts per million carbon dioxide, and what we're at today is about 395. Yeah.
Right. Well, what happens when you overlay the population growth curve on something like that?
I haven't actually tried it, but one of the things about this is kind of a cumulative amount of CO2 that's been added to the atmosphere. And it might correlate well to how much is being added at any one time, but yeah, they're not really the same thing. Okay, yeah, sorry about the quality of this picture. This is global land and ocean temperatures recorded starting in 1880, and some of those older averages over the whole Earth are a little less reliable. But one of the issues that is still kind of a mystery is it kind of goes up here until the 1930s or so, kind of levels out for a while up to about the 1970s, and then has gone up considerably since then. There's no real smoking gun for that leveling out, and all during that time CO2 has been increasing. Volcanic eruptions may have something to do with it. Changes in the sun itself. But no one's really found the smoking gun for that time when it leveled out. In the continental U.S., the observational record shows that we've been really hot the last year. So this is warmest 12-month periods for the contiguous U.S. So these are actually overlapping periods of 12 months each. And I guess the one starting in September 2011 through August 2012 is yet to be released. So the most recent is the one on the right there. August 2011 to July 2012. And actually the Northwest has kind of been the exception to that. It hasn't had such a very warm year. And as you go to the left, the next one is the record from the prior month. So it's overlapping by 11 months and just substituting July 2011 for July 2012, and just going back, several of the last months have been record highs for the continental U.S. as a whole.
What is so, this measuring? Temperature departure from 20th?
Yeah,
I understand.
So if you take the average temperature over the whole 20th century, for the continental U.S., you're saying, how different is this 12-month period from that?
So it's an average. The last 12 months were an average of 3.3 degrees.
Yep.
Higher.
Is that Fahrenheit or centigrade?
These are Fahrenheit. Yeah, because this is information intended for public consumption, not scientist consumption.
In the U.S., other places.
In the 48 states. Actually, Alaska was a very significant departure from this in the past year.
Departure in which direction?
Cooler? Alaska had a very cool last year.
But in general, they're warming much faster.
In general, yeah. So, over the long term, Alaska and eastern Siberia have some of the strongest trends in temperature. So, yeah, that again is a reminder that even though some of these trends are happening in one area, they might not be happening over the shorter term in all areas. So here's what I'm calling the hierarchy of uncertainty, which is a term that I've used quite a few times. Uncertainty in global warming results is not created equal. The least uncertain thing shown in that Mauna Loa time series, and the group that now runs that in Boulder, Colorado, that's their home office, they now have quite a few observatories around the world doing the same thing, and they all show that. Observed increase in CO2 as well as methane and nitrous oxide, and actually the chlorofluorocarbons are leveling out. Good. Just a bit less certain. Observed and expected temperature increases. So those changes in global temperature that we showed before, we wonder a little bit why it leveled out between 1940 and 1970. And using models, the expected temperature increases have a little higher amount of uncertainty. More challenging is looking at this whole record and really pinning it on human causes. So that's tougher, and the biggest challenge I think nowadays is the impacts and the things that people really care about. These tend to be the most uncertain things, and one of the reasons why is that it requires knowledge of very localized trends in climate, which tend to be more noisy, less consistent over time. And it also impacts require getting it right in going from the climate to the impact. And that's the thing that adds greater uncertainty.
What's your feel about Bill McKibben's work and the 350 parts per million project?
350
Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Could you repeat the question?
I was asking what your thoughts are on Bill McKibben's kind of organization and 350.org, the idea that we should aim to 350 parts per million CO2.
Yeah, well, it's already at 395.
Right.
So, yeah. This is a group that has made a big push to severely limit greenhouse gas emissions. It's mitigation is not entirely my area. Mm-hmm. So.
But what about that goal of 350?
I'm aware of that group. I'm not quite as convinced of that goal as some others are. Actually, I'm going to discuss the book that I'm sort of recommending a little later. Dr. James Hansen is the originator of that particular target. Actually I should pull that out. I was meaning to do a quotation of one of the passages from that book. It's a little bit arbitrary, but it's worthwhile to have a goal. Yeah, so there's no particular spot on that continuum, like 350 parts per million, that is a particular breaking point, but it's good to have a goal. And that's a very challenging one to reach.
But this goal of
reducing
levels from where we're even at now is probably a good thing to be thinking about.
Yeah, I haven't really brought much information on this, but there are some proposed technological fixes for removing CO2 from the atmosphere.
Can I ask about connection or disconnection between the least certain, the observed increase in greenhouse gases, and the more challenging attribution to human causes?
Mm-hmm.
That suggests that there are other proffered explanations for why greenhouse gases have increased other than human causes. What are those?
It's not the attribution of increased greenhouse gases to human causes. It's the attribution of observed changes in climate to human causes. Okay? So correlation is not causation. If there's an increase in greenhouse gases at the same time as there's an increase in air temperatures worldwide, that fact alone does not confirm that it's caused by humans. Okay?
Yeah, I understand that your sequence of points of reference, but at what point does that break down? If we can't, do we agree that the greenhouse gas increase is something that's created by humans?
Yeah, we have other reasons to believe that.
Okay, if we believe that, then we believe that there's a correlation. Am I right in thinking there's a correlation between greenhouse gas and temperature change or climate change? Do we believe that?
Yeah, say it again.
Do we believe that there is a fairly well-established correlation between increasing greenhouse gases and changes in climatic changes? Changes in climate and
yes.
Temperature. So where does the sequence break down?
And in the observations, the correlation is not high enough that everyone's entirely convinced that trend is due to that. So yeah, the overall global change that is quite well established. So yeah, it's still in the more challenging category relative to those other things. Getting to the book by James Hansen, one of the things that he has been criticized for by other members of the community in last month, I think, was his very strong statement that droughts in the U.S. that have happened recently and droughts in some other part of the world are attributable to human causes. So drought is much more in this greater uncertainty category than temperature is. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that these are really two separate questions. One is, do increase in greenhouse gases have an effect? And I guess the answer to that is yes. Now,
yes.
The second question is, how much of this is our doing?
Right.
Okay, those are two very different questions.
How much is
right. So how much of it is our doing is attribution to human causes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. Yeah. What are some of the other factors that are likely suspects for increasing greenhouse?
Well, like I said, natural variability is real. It's always been with us. It always will be with us. But at the same time, I don't want to give you the impression that I'm not a believer in human-caused warming.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there is this human-caused warming overlaid, and you don't know which part of that temperature record is due to which of those things. Yeah.
But the longer-term record, not just back 100 years or something, shows clearly that we haven't been up as high as we are now.
That's right.
For a really long period of time. I mean, millions of years. And it shows that temperature closely correlates with the level of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that...
Yeah, but correlation is not causation.
I understand. No, I understand that. But we also have recognized that the reason we're going up so fast now is all the fossil fuels that we've been burning since the Industrial Revolution.
All right. Well, I'm going to read a different passage from this than I was planning to read first. So, in science, you want to examine evidence that seems to disagree with your preliminary interpretation. You must evaluate contradictory evidence to make sure that you are not fooling yourself.
Does that say something about whether or not we're contributing gases from burning fossil fuels?
Oh, absolutely it does. It does, but I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that when I say correlation is not causation,
you're being cautious because that's
I am being cautious because I'm a scientist and I need to examine evidence that seems to disagree.
Right, but that doesn't mean that we are not the cause of the increased gases from fossil fuel combustion. I mean, that's something we need to own as the effect we're having. But I realize that that's not the focus of what you need to do as a scientist.
That's right. But nevertheless, within that understanding, there are these various categories of things that we're trying to anticipate and attribute to various causes, and they have different levels of uncertainty.
Yeah. Right. But I think you need to characterize, you know, the levels of uncertainty.
Like, that's what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not hearing you say the attribution to human causes. I mean, are you talking about the different, you know, how much can be from volcanic eruptions? How much could be from combustion of fossil fuels?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what this means.
Okay.
The attribution to human causes. There are other possible causes. And a lot of those are more short-term. So as time goes by, we do expect greater changes in global air temperature. And that will give greater confidence in some of these conclusions. From the theoretical standpoint, we understand that relatively well. So we can make some of these projections using the models, even though they're a little less uncertain or a little less certain than the observed increases in greenhouse gases. So yeah, these different things that we think we understand kind of fall along different points in this hierarchy of uncertainty.
Is another category, or maybe it's the major one or the last one, but the category of whether or not a tipping point exists and where that tipping point might be.
Yeah, I have a lot of problems with the idea of tipping points because there are so many definitions of what a tipping point might be. One significant tipping point, I think, that is showing evidence of having been passed was just in the news about the amount of ice in the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah.
And one of my close colleagues is his primary job now is ice in the Great Lakes, but he's also studied ice in the Arctic Ocean. And his idea is that partially it's due to global climate change, and for this year in particular, it's due to a pattern of winds over the Arctic Ocean that's driving the ice out through the straits between Greenland and Norway. So that's an example of a combination of human-caused actions and a natural occurrence.
But are those winds different because of things that are happening with climate change?
No, it's a natural oscillation.
So it does, it's come and goes.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
You know, maybe this is too simplified, but as a scientist and as all the body of scientists are observing this issue that's of great importance to all of us, scientists would say you don't make conclusions on smaller amounts of information. You need larger amounts, taking into a lot of factors into time, whereas we as citizens of the country, we want to fix things. And that that usually means like tipping points. You know, you want to do something about it right away, whereas a scientist, you're saying, we don't quite know how this is all interacting.
A little further into my prepared presentation here, I'm going to talk about adaptation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a section on mitigation and adaptation. But this other thing that speaks more specifically to the idea of hierarchy of uncertainty, this is Jim Hansen talking to Vice President Cheney's Climate Task Force in 2001.
Oh,
jeez.
What a hostile.
Yeah, Cheney convened this group, and it was a bunch of cabinet-level people and Cheney himself, and had people come in front of them, and one of them was named Dan Albritton, director of the NOAA Aeronomy Lab, which he was my boss for a short time. Dan Albritton gave an interview called Climate Change, What We Know and What We Don't. Each of his hand-drawn charts included a little thermometer or confidence index with fluid rising to a level between 0 and 10. Our understanding that the natural greenhouse effect keeps Earth much warmer than it would be otherwise, rated at 10, for example, while our ability to describe regional effects of global warming rated only a 3. So the more specific the question you're asking in terms of what location you're looking at, what effect you're looking at, the greater the uncertainty. I'm going to skip past that. Okay, so a few examples of impacts. This has colors kind of washed out, but this is a range of possible changes in sea level due to increases in global temperature. And the more certain part of changes in sea level is the part that's driven by changes in ocean temperatures driving different densities. So a different volume of water in the ocean given the same amount of mass of water in the ocean. The more uncertain part of this is how much is contributed by glaciers, in particular Greenland and Antarctica. And what's going on in Greenland was largely unanticipated. The extent of melt that's been observed in Greenland the last few years. This is a change in the USDA's definitions of hardiness zones for various kinds of plants, and everything is expected to migrate north in North America. This is a really poor quality.
But it really shows up.
Figure. Yeah, this is for different forest types and projected migrations in those, provided that they can find the right soil and the seeds can be transported to the place where they're likely to grow. And this is effect on the left, consecutive dry days. So what's the longest run of no precipitation that you're likely to get in various places? And this has a high amount of variability by location. And the basic pattern is the dry get drier and the wet get wetter. And soil moisture anomalies are shown on the right. The top row is showing from approximately 2000, what's the difference when you get to mid-21st century, 2046 to 2065. And then the bottom is showing what's going to happen later in the century. So the soil moisture generally is lower, but there's a little bit of a mix in there too. And one of my kind of side areas of interest is East Africa. That's really an exception in this particular study. Now, this is some of my own research on lake levels of the Great Lakes, and this is part of the motivation for my Wednesday talk, why temperature doesn't matter. The basic conclusion is that people have overestimated the importance of air temperature on evaporation in certain areas, and this was initially considered kind of contrarian, but a lot of people have come to understand that the processes are more complex than people had initially understood. So this is showing using an older method, the lake levels start with the solid black curves there for Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, and Lake Erie. And using an older method of estimating changes in lake levels up to the late 21st century, it gives you those curves that are lower than that. And using a newer method that's more based on the energy budget of the surface rather than the air temperature, it actually gives a rise in lake levels. So this is with one set of inputs. There's another set of inputs that I haven't shown, and that one has the old method shows a big drop in lake levels, the newer method shows a smaller drop. So there's quite a large amount of uncertainty remaining.
I skipped over the point of a year, but how many years or what year was that?
We're averaging over a 20-year projection.
So you're projecting out to like the 2030s? Is that what you're saying?
No, the projection is for 2080 to 2100.
Okay.
Okay, so this is just listing the various publications that have weighed in on each of these sides, and my name is actually in both lists. But hypothesis, the true answer may be less water early and more water later. And the early part is during the time frame when we're losing ice cover on the Great Lakes. And that'll max out when you get zero ice cover. So I think that's something we'll be investigating some more in the future.
Could you pause at the time when there will be zero ice cover?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, we can talk about the 4 degrees Celsius threshold for the Great Lakes too, offline if you want.
Sure.
This is projections of changes in growth habitat for Chinook salmon, and this is a little bit old. That's my colleague Doran Mason down in the corner. He was the one primarily responsible for this work. But it actually gives a longer growing season for Chinook salmon in the Great Lakes.
Can you explain what you're showing there? I don't understand.
Yeah, I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time here, but This is for Lake Michigan. The colors are showing up horribly down here. This actually says January over here, even though you can't see it, and it's December on the other side. So this is
it's across the year.
Whoop.
I don't want to go ahead anyway. So it's across 1 year.
It's across 1 year, and
you're showing temperature.
The vertical axis is showing depth in Lake Michigan. And the colors are showing the growth rate potential. So the dark blue in here is, this is bad for growth of Chinook salmon. And then...
So it will get to be better a longer period of time in a year.
Except this is showing that this period during the summer near the surface is bad, but it's expected that they can swim down deeper and escape that condition. All right, so a few paths of mitigation, reduced fossil fuel use from all sorts of things, and this particular drawing here shows one way of doing that. Like one guy says, whose name I forget, what we need is not a silver bullet, but silver buckshot. Meaning you need to take a lot of different approaches to solve the whole problem. Sequestration of CO2 is one possibility. And one of the things that James Hansen has recommended in the past is that one of the easier paths, in the short term at least, is to concentrate on greenhouse gases other than CO2, because they do contribute a significant amount of the warming, methane, nitrous oxide, CFCs.
What is this drawing? I can see that it's a flat plate collector, but what is that?
Yeah, this is actually a solar-driven heating system.
Oh, okay. So you're saying move to solar from fossil fuels.
That's one path, yeah.
Okay.
That's one piece of the silver buckshot. Paths of adaptation, there are really only a few general remarks you can make about this, and the devil is in the details. So in many cases, adaptation can be achieved, but each piece of adaptation has its own set of solutions. You know, you have to ask, what problem am I trying to solve? What do I know about climate change that might affect that? And part of the problem is that it deals in a lot of the less certain aspects of climate change. You need to understand what kind of climate change is happening locally, so that introduces uncertainty. How is that going to affect your system of interest? Municipal water supply in Muskegon, for example. And what is your proposed course of action? And understand the uncertainties involved in that. And in some cases, you're going to answer yes to the question, is the cure worse than the disease? Some cases, no. All right, then I listed some online resources. Climate.gov is the NOAA one. Skepticalscience.com. And this is a group who have tried to take back the term skeptic from the climate change doubters. So they have this kind of convoluted word, but or mantra, but they say being skeptical about the skeptics. And it's really the role of scientists is to be skeptical, but the climate change doubters have really co-opted that word to sort of say with certainty that this is not a problem. So I would say that they are not the true skeptics, and that's what they're trying to get across by calling this website skepticalscience.com. EPA has a website, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has its website hosted in Switzerland. So that's a lot of the, a lot of it is quite technical on that website, but that's the official international organization that issues the reports once every 6 years, and the next one is due in 2013, and the previous one was published in 2007. Now I'm trying to remember whether it was the 2007 or 2008 Nobel Peace Prize that was shared by the IPCC and Al Gore. Yeah, and I don't have the actual web address for the next one, and I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but this one is called CAKE. And that one's about transferring relevant information to people who have something to protect from climate change effects. And those pictures I showed with Tom Cruise and Gwyneth Paltrow are from celebritiesweating.com. So that's the end of what I have prepared for today. Yeah.
The stuff in the press that I read is suggesting that we've basically we've committed ourselves to a 2-degree temperature rise. Right. Mm-hmm. That's where we are right now with our CO2 emissions in the atmosphere. We've committed ourselves to a 2-degree temperature rise as we
that's as someone's experience. Estimate.
What
yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. The committed temperature increase is a very relevant concept. So, because the oceans don't respond instantaneously, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have already committed us to a further increase in temperature. So, yeah, people have done climate model runs using the assumption that the greenhouse gases are going to remain constant over the next 100 years. And that does still yield an increase in temperature, air temperature and ocean temperature. And really the oceans are a major driver of the whole system.
Well, they've been a sink, but then as it gets drier, they release it.
You're talking about how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, okay? But we're talking, and this is a hypothetical assumption. What's that?
You're talking about temperature.
We're talking about what if the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere were to remain constant for a long time. The oceans have not reached their temperature that's in equilibrium with that amount of CO2. So that's going to continue to increase despite having no increase in greenhouse gases.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues with CO2 is that you're seeing acidification of the ocean, which is making it less hospitable for fish and more hospitable for jellyfish.
Right.
Yeah. When you look at what the oceans have done since the last ice age, the sea level's risen about 400 feet. And so for skeptics to doubt that it could rise another 5 or 10 feet seems questionable.
Yeah, the ocean acidification really came as a surprise about around 2000. People really hadn't anticipated, just didn't think about that, and sort of suddenly realized that that's a problem in addition to the warming effects of CO2.
Because the warming effects conceivably can be dealt with by geoengineering. You can spew a lot of sulfur.
I'm going to have something to say about that, too.
You're going to say something? You're going to talk about geoengineering?
That's going to be in the... which presentation is that in? That's going to be the Wednesday one.
Ah, okay.
Yes? Actually, it's after 12 o'clock, so okay. People want to leave.
It seems, just very quickly, seems that the dialogue is changing. Rather than preventing this, we're now talking about how you cope with it.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the difference between the mitigation and adaptation. And it's seeming that some measure of both are necessary. From a scientific standpoint, the mitigation is much more straightforward. The adaptation has much more uncertainty involved in it.
Maybe Holland will go away.
So, yeah,
and the low-lying islands.
Yeah. Well, the easiest thing to do is what they say are no regrets solutions. Mm-hmm. So if you, I guess I'll use the municipal water supply problem again. If you've got a change in lake levels for your intake, you might want to just put that intake deeper in the lake so that you make sure that you've always got a supply.
My favorite cartoon on this is people driving through Iowa at night and seeing what looks like the whole state covered with fireflies. And what it is somebody invented afterburners you put on the rear end of cows and pigs. It takes care of all the methane problems. There you go. So there's some mitigation.
No, actually, yeah, that's a misunderstanding. Most of the methane from cattle is... Yeah, they belch.
So they need belch methods. Yeah. They need to get both in.
Thank you for this.
Sure, that's right. Coming.